Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I am your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so today, we're going to continue this series on taking collaborative projects to the next level and really exploring how you can use design thinking as a roadmap for collaborative projects. Now, in the last episode, the last podcast that we did, we looked at why collaborative projects are vital for students. But if we're being honest, creative projects are really hard to pull off in groups. And we'll now explore some of the reasons why. So here are five really good reasons not to do collaborative projects with your students. Group projects. Say those two words and you'll instantly notice the face of sheer dread as a handful of students calculate just how much extra work they'll need to do in order to make up for the slackers in their assigned group. Look around the room and you'll see the scattered sense of relief from a few of the slackers who know they just got a free pass. But you'll also notice a shy student who is already nervous about spending hours in a group with no time to process things individually. You'll see that student who struggles, who looks like a slacker, but it's only because he really wants to give up before he disappoints his team. There are so many kids in this class that are not excited about the group project. And to be honest, neither are you. And there are so many ways that group work can go wrong. It's no wonder then that many teachers are reticent about assigning group projects. It's kind of something they do because they feel like they have to, but really not because they want to. And the following are some solid reasons to scrap collaborative projects altogether. Number one, there's not enough time. Another way to say it is it's not covered in the curriculum app. Your weeks are already jam-packed as it is, and adding a creative collaborative project can feel overwhelming. There's a reason so many teachers wait until the very end of the year to do these types of projects. It's easier to pull off after testing is over, when the curriculum map gives you a little more slack and there's less pressure. Number two, some students won't participate. Too often group work doesn't work. Remember that group project you did in the ninth grade? One member wandered the classroom talking to friends, and two other members did the least possible work required. And meanwhile, you were stuck doing the job of four people, and now, as an educator, you don't want to impose this same experience onto your students. It makes sense. Number three, students don't know how to work collaboratively. Now, most groups struggle with metacognition and project planning. In some cases, they struggle to communicate without fighting with each other. It can be easier to avoid larger collaborative projects and just stick to smaller bursts of cooperative learning activities instead. Number four, the class gets noisy, crazy, and chaotic. It's easy to dismiss this by saying, we'll just embrace the chaos, or it's constructive chaos, or learning should be messy. But teaching is hard, even when things are running kind of smoothly. And while it's true that learning should, on some level, feel messy, it shouldn't feel chaotic all the time. And it shouldn't feel unsafe. And for that reason, you probably don't want to have a crazy class. Number five, introverts get lost in the shuffle, and they eventually shut down. In Quiet, Susan Cain argues about the dangers of constantly focusing on small groups to the detriment of introverts who have not had the opportunity to process information individually or to work in silence and solitude. You've probably seen this in certain group projects where students talk over one another while a quieter, deeper thinking student eventually just gives up. And so there you have it. Those are five solid reasons to just scrap the collaborative projects altogether. And yet we also know that most of our students will someday work in professions where they will have to collaborate with colleagues on long-term creative projects. I previously wrote about this and had a podcast episode. It was my last one, if you go back and look at it or listen to it, either way. But you get the idea. Collaborative projects actually really benefit students. They learn how to communicate, they're empowered, they develop a maker mindset, they learn how to do project management, they gain perseverance, they engage in adaptability and iterative thinking. You get the idea. It's actually really important that they learn how to do this. But what happens when it fails? What happens when it just isn't working? Well, what if we changed our approach to creative projects so that students worked interdependently with built-in accountability? What if each group collectively owned the creative process in a way that promoted inquiry, research, ideation, project management, iterative thinking, all those things I just mentioned? And what if we could pull this off without having to cram it into a packed curriculum? Now, this is why I love design thinking. It works like a roadmap for collaborative projects so that students can get the most out of the creative process. So I want to share kind of how design thinking works as this roadmap. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about design thinking and kind of its history. Design thinking is a flexible framework used in the arts and engineering for product development. It's used in social and civic spaces. It's used everywhere outside of education. And although it's become more popular in recent years, design thinking is actually a process that's been evolving for over half a century. It first emerged in the design science community, where MIT professor Buckminster Fuller brought together multidisciplinary teams in things like visual design, industrial design, architecture, ecology, even ergonomics, which is not necessarily what you think of, to develop creative solutions to complex problems. And at the same time, in Scandinavia, the cooperative design movement rejected this expert-driven model and focused on a kind of a less hierarchical, I'm trying to say that word, and a more democratic methodology. It was meant to be empathy-driven instead of being top-down. And by the 1980s, these ideas really converged with our current concept of design thinking as both human-centered and process-driven. And you see this with the D-School frameworks, the IDEO frameworks. Now, note that design thinking here is a roadmap, and it's not an instruction manual. There's a difference. Instruction manuals tell you kind of step-by-step precisely what you need to do. But roadmaps, by contrast, inspire possibilities. And they help us figure out where we are going, that's the process-driven side, while also allowing teams to make decisions and forge their own way, which is the human-centered part. Now, although there's lots of different design thinking frameworks, AJ Giuliani and I developed the launch cycle about 2 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. And we took our favorite ideas from several other frameworks and added our own unique twist, namely the inquiry phase, the research phase, and the final launch phase. But we also know this. We've had this conversation all the time. We know that people are going to modify it because you're the teacher. You know your class better than I do, better than AJ does, better than anyone else. So if you try out the launch cycle and a piece of it's not working for you, then change it. Do your own thing. So we're going to look at design thinking, look at the launch cycle in particular, and really kind of figure out how this would lead to better collaboration. So look, listen, and learn. This beginning phase taps into each student's awareness and prior knowledge. It's a chance to get individual buy-in before asking the groups to collaborate together. But it can also be a chance for groups to clarify their main purpose for meeting together. And it helps them kind of clarify that the problem they'll tackle, the group they might show empathy toward, the product they're going to create. This early beginning phase is a great way to form a cohesive group. And that becomes significant because later you want students to be truly collaborating on a deep level, right? The next phase is the inquiry phase, and that's ask tons of questions. So we have the L, look, listen, and learn. The A is ask tons of questions. Now, after starting with awareness, students will then just ask lots of different questions. And this is a chance for every student, regardless of skill level, regardless of prior knowledge, to engage in this inquiry process. We have a rule here, or we did when I was a middle school teacher. I still have this rule as a college professor. And it's that there are no dumb questions. The goal is to simply tap into each student's natural curiosity and see where it goes. Groups then work interdependently to combine their questions. Every student has a voice from this early stage, which increases ownership and motivation and engagement. So in this phase, you really have a ton of buy-in. And that's going to be significant because that is what allows them to do the hard, heavy lifting later. Understand the process or problem. In this phase, students engage in research. It can help to break a team of 4 to 6 into smaller groups with partners who can then lean on each other. In some cases, you might meet with a small group who struggles with reading and research, and that's okay. Even if some students are working slower or have a harder time with things like informational reading, they can still contribute something awesome to their group's research. Note, too, that the research doesn't just have to be reading. Students can conduct needs assessments, they can gather data, observe natural phenomenon, they can watch videos, listen to podcasts, interview experts. There's all kinds of different ways they can do research. And in the end, group members meet together to debrief what information they have found and to discuss how this will impact their design. The next phase is navigate ideas. After gaining new background knowledge, teams then brainstorm their initial concept for a prototype. The following is a brainstorm process, and there's a video that kind of shows it, but I'm going to walk you through it briefly. It starts with having students brainstorm individually first. They then meet collaboratively. They all share their ideas. They bring in someone from another group who will kind of add ideas to it. Then they look at all their ideas they have and they combine ideas. And then after that, they begin to analyze, pick apart ideas, eliminate ideas, and then ultimately narrow it down to their final solution. Now, once they have a solid concept, once they've really figured that out, students then engage in metacognition and project management. And in this phase, they're planning out their tasks, they're setting their deadlines. In some cases, they're choosing their roles. They're figuring out what to do with materials. They're really engaging in project planning. Now, as a teacher, you can assign roles or and you can help them break down the tasks. And you may need to do that. If you teach second grade, this phase can be really heavily structured, and you can honestly be doing a lot of it for them and then kind of pull the scaffolding back as you do more and more collaborative projects. But I'd also say this, sometimes young kids can be amazingly adept at planning. You just have to help them to do it in a way that's a little more realistic, because they don't have the same executive function skills as older kids, and they may not know, you know, how long things are going to take to do. Well, we've now walked through the LAU in phase, and now with a clear concept, they move to the C, which is create a prototype. In this phase, students create the product. Now, it could be a physical prototype, a digital work, a work of art, an event like a play, or a service like going to the food bank. You get the idea. Students might work individually in pairs or collectively as a group. Ideally, they will find ways to discover different ways to incorporate one another's strengths while ensuring everyone participates. Now, this doesn't always work perfectly, but that's okay. It's a learning process, and even as adults, we sometimes struggle with finding our roles within a group. But in my experience, this is honestly where we have the highest engagement, And this is where if they've done the groundwork of the L-A-U-N phases, they're going to do the work on the C. And so in my experience, this is actually a time where most students are really involved. The next is the H, the highlight and fix. In this phase, students engage in peer feedback and self-assessment. In the past, I've used this 20-minute peer feedback system that I developed. It's pretty similar to the critical friends structure. And it's a chance for you as a teacher to also conference one-on-one with students and to help them monitor their progress, set new goals, and try out new approaches. Finally, they launch it to the world. In this final phase, students launch their product to an authentic audience. Here, the group works collaboratively to determine the methods for reaching their audience. And ultimately, if they haven't done it already, they get to define who the audience is. So let's look at why design thinking works. If that's the roadmap, then why is it working? Well, number one, it aligns to the standards. True, it takes time, but it's not something you're adding to your plate. Each of those phases will line up to specific standards. So instead of thinking about, you know, adding something to your plate, it's more like rearranging your plate. And it's a way to rearrange the plate so that students get to be the chefs rather than waiting for things to be added to the plate. Number two, design thinking increases student participation by focusing on ownership. Each student has something to contribute from the first phase on. So even if students struggle academically, they have something of value to add to the project. Now, this doesn't mean that every student will be able to contribute the same amount of work, the same amount of level. You don't teach average students. There is no average. But that's okay. Every student can contribute something to a creative project. Number three, design thinking helps students learn to work collaboratively by providing interdependent tasks. For example, they each contribute questions to the Ask Tons of Questions phase. In the Navigate Ideas phase, the brainstorming allows them to work independently first and then collaboratively. The peer feedback structure requires interdependent work so that every student has a voice in the process. So through this entire thing, they're leaning on each other. They're depending on each other, and that creates even greater group cohesion. Number four, design thinking provides structure so that group projects don't devolve into chaos. Know that certain parts are a little bit looser, like researching or prototyping, while other parts are highly structured, like the ideation or peer feedback process. Now, the goal of this structure isn't to keep things neat and tidy. Instead, it's meant to facilitate the creative process. And as a teacher, you can always scale back the structure and allow students to modify the process. But it does allow things to move more smoothly. Number five, design thinking honors the role of introverts. If you look at the tiny house project, you'll notice that students can work individually during the understand the process or problem phase, as well as the create a prototype phase. But even in other phases, students are asked to process things individually first before meeting with their groups. And that's important because it really allows them to be introverts, to process things on their own. And that's important while at the same time, the extroverts are getting to work on this collaborative project and be social and talk to each other and process things with fellow team members. Now, to be clear, this doesn't always work perfectly. You'll have students who are reluctant to work because they're scared or because they feel lethargic or because they've experienced trauma. You'll have students who struggle with executive function and they need to have you help them figure out what to do. You'll have moments when group members argue with each other and times where you have to nag a group to make up their minds. But I get it. This isn't a magic formula. It's a roadmap for an epic adventure of creativity. And like all epic adventures, there will be challenges along the way. But it's totally worth it because, like all epic adventures, the protagonists are different in the end. They've become makers. Hey, thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. If you enjoy it at all, I'm going to tell you there's two things. First of all, there's a design thinking toolkit and the tiny house project. It's in the show notes here. It's also on the blog post connected to it. And then the other piece I want to tell you is if you leave a review, it helps people find this podcast, and that would mean the world to me. So have a wonderful day and make something awesome.